So, welcome everyone. Thanks for being here. I believe we are live on the webcast now, or we should be live on the webcast. Everyone saw we gave you the ample opportunity to read the extensive safe harbor provision. I want to make sure everyone fully notes that. If you want to hear my rereading of it, it's in the webcast this morning. Thanks for coming in. Obviously, totally coincidental that you are here to see a fabulous Star Wars movie and spend some time with Christine and the IR team and with Bob. Totally coincidental that this morning we had a big announcement, but fortuitous for us because it gives you guys a chance to hear from Bob and Christine directly. And I'll turn it over to Bob. We don't really have an agenda other than take your questions if you want to make some opening comments.
Yeah, I'll make a couple. First of all, thank you for being here. It is an incredible coincidence. I guess I throw my Star Wars script out and talk about something else. But I do want to say that we're incredibly excited about this next installment of Star Wars, The Last Jedi, and glad you're going to get a chance to see it. This is the third one, as you know, that we've made. The first two did incredibly well, and we have very, very high hopes for this. Great reviews, really globally, which is fantastic. And of course, this is the eighth of what was the original series that George created, and J.J. Abrams tomorrow morning is pitching his story for the ninth. And then we've got a lot of.
We're not webcasting that.
No, we're not. And we got a lot of development beyond that. So that's all quite good. Before we get into this, I just want to introduce two people who are with me today. Alan Braverman, who's our general counsel, and Kevin Mayer, who's head of corporate strategic planning, M&A, and a few other things. This deal wouldn't be possible really without Kevin's unbelievably hard work. He's probably the only one of the companies that had less sleep than I have had. I was in London yesterday, so I just got back. I don't know what city I'm in, what time it is, or whatever. But Kevin has done an unbelievable job for us in this regard, and I'm deeply appreciative. We've been talking all day today to a variety of different groups, including the press, members of the government here and outside the United States, to other folks in the investment community, and to executives at 21st Century Fox. And so it's been a long, talked-out day. So I don't really have much to add to what's already been said, except I think it probably would be best just to take questions. That's all right.
Okay.
Laura.
Yeah, Laura.
Okay, so under your big.
Hold on one sec. We're going to have to wait for a microphone because we are being webcast. So we'll call on people and just hold on till we get the mics to you.
Okay, Laura Martin, Needham. So Bob, with your big strategic hat, to me, I see competition between the over-the-top services you're going to launch under the Disney, ESPN brands, and Hulu. But I know you have better thought on how these things fit together. So could you talk about how those fit together in your mind and why those don't directly compete, and which I don't really get? And then also Avatar. Have you talked to Cameron? And is he all as excited as you are about building Avatar into the 360-degree Disney empire?
So on the second part of the question, I did talk to Jim Cameron a few hours ago. We've got a really good relationship with Jim, having licensed Avatar for our parks and having built the first one, the Land Pandora in Orlando, that he was blown away by in terms of the promise that it fulfilled. Because when I first sat with Jim to talk about it, I talked about a concept that was beyond just an attraction. I talked about a whole immersive land. He could not believe what we ultimately created. And so he's thrilled about this. Obviously, he sees all sorts of other opportunities. And the fact that we have a relationship already, and he's already been impressed with how Disney has handled one of his prized possessions, he's very excited about that. And there's great potential there. In terms of your first question, this is evolving because the business of going over-the-top direct-to-consumer really is still a relatively nascent business, although obviously Netflix probably wouldn't look at it that way. But what we were doing was creating really two different OTT, DTC products. One was sports, and the other one what I'll call family, which was going to include Disney, Marvel, Pixar, and Star Wars. And what we saw doing was bringing them both out reasonably priced. We have not announced price, but I did suggest that they would both be substantially below what Netflix currently charges for a few reasons. First of all, on the sports side, it's really an ESPN Plus product. It's an add-on to ESPN. Their primary business will remain the channel business, and delivered on under relatively traditional circumstances. But there's going to be a product on top of that, which would basically serve the ultimate sports fan with thousands and thousands of more programs. And we're still going to have an investor meeting in February, probably, to talk much more specifically about that, because it's going to launch soon after. And then we're going to have, on the family side, again, a product that was family-oriented but priced well below, because the volume would be much less than Netflix. When this came along and we saw the opportunity to both own the controlling stake of Hulu and fuel Hulu with even more product, what we envision is actually taking Hulu and making it basically the home of adult programming, where the ABC product would go, where the FX product would go, where the output of the studios that was not branded Disney, Marvel, Pixar, et cetera, would go. And then we would go to market with essentially three apps, all distinct in terms of their product, but all managed with the same technological, basically, infrastructure, same customer acquisition approach, customer retention, data collection, ad serving, et cetera. But give consumers choice. And they'd all be reasonably priced. So if a consumer wanted to buy a bundle of them, that would be fine. But if they wanted to buy them individually because they were just sports fans or just wanted family or just wanted adult programming, they could do that. Because as we see the world, we think that the trend is likely to be consumers wanting to have essentially more authority or exercise more authority over the packages that they buy or create. No reason why you couldn't envision one bundle of them if the consumer wanted it, but we didn't want to, for just the sports fan, for instance, them have to really buy the family-oriented product as a for instance. Doesn't mean it wouldn't evolve in a different manner if we feel putting them all together under one umbrella. We wouldn't do that, but that our current thinking is not to do that.
Barton.
Wait for the mic, Barton.
So I was curious about the synergy number, the $2 billion number, which is a very big percentage of the EBITDA that you're acquiring. You know, I was wondering if you could give us more color on where that comes from, because it strikes me that Fox was a big company that should have been at scale. And so I'm a little bit surprised at the level of cost synergy you see. And I was wondering if you could talk about where that comes from.
It's primarily going to come when you take the two organizations and you look at the overlap and the redundancies. You know, we will go through a process. Nothing's been predetermined in terms of individuals or specific things, but we've looked at the activities, and that would include both domestic as well as international efficiencies. And it was through a process that Kevin was involved in for weeks and weeks that we went through this. And we believe it's achievable, and we think the time frame that we've given that they'll be fully achieved by 2021, which is the second fiscal year after the anticipated closing. We believe that that's a very doable number.
And the plan is to take the best of both companies and put them together, people and product. And we believe the result will deliver the kind of efficiencies and synergies that we talked about. But we, you know, it's not going to be in all of us and none of them. They've got a very strong talent pool and a lot of great IP and the ability to create a lot of IP. And so our approach is going to be essentially to field the best team with the best product out there.
Let's go. We'll do Jason. Is that Jason? And then Alexia next. So let's get a mic over here.
Jason Bazinet, Citi. Mr. Iger, when I think about the assets that you're trying to acquire from Fox, there are some where I think the street gets it with unanimity, the production capability that Fox brings on the TV and film side and the library. There's a bucket where there are sort of raging debates about whether it's an attractive asset or not, which I would call the Sky stake and potentially all of Sky. And then there's a bucket where the questions we get from investors is they say, oh, you know, more linear cable channels, Nat Geo, FX. You know, that's the bad bucket, right? So can you just...
I'm not going to say answer right to that.
Okay, but can you just comment on sort of your thinking around the totality of the assets you bought sort of within that framework, not really, I think everyone gets the first bucket, so really it's more about bucket two and bucket
three. Well, first of all, if you, which we did, look at the revenue of the combined company just for 2017, you could quickly conclude that the advertising component and the affiliate component of the total revenue is actually lower than what the advertising and the affiliate component is of our company today, as a percentage of the total. In addition, if you add Sky, the full stake in Sky, and we're hopeful that that will be acquired, the international component from a revenue perspective of the entire entity, the combined, is 40%. Substantially greater than, I think, the mid to
23
low 20s for us today. So we're looking at really not increasing risk from a percentage of revenue basis in advertising or affiliate fees, which you could argue are maybe being impacted the most with disruption. And we believe that the international component diversifies the company substantially in a variety of directions. I'll get to Sky. In terms of FX, Nat Geo, and the 22 regional sports networks, yes, they're all distributed under relatively traditional terms, but we like each business individually, regardless of what happens to the ecosystem of multi-channel providers. For instance, on the FX side, great production capabilities, a decent brand, edgier adult brand, one that could easily feed a direct-to-consumer business quite successfully, and one that might be able to, in effect, stand on its own in some respects, in a different business model, distribution-wise, and it also diversifies our portfolio of products because we're really not in the business of creating that kind of television today. On the Nat Geo side, we've got a terrific brand for kids and family, aimed obviously at nature and the environment. We've wanted in the Disney side to be in that space on a much deeper basis globally. We've put our toes in the water, but we've never quite gone there. We think that brand gives us license to do that. That's a brand that is a perfect complement to Disney in a direct-to-consumer business. So if for instance, if multi-channel universe were suddenly to go away, and it's not going to happen suddenly, we would put that in with a Disney product and ultimately go direct-to-consumer with it in a complementary fashion. On the regional sports front, there's huge passion, as you know, for regional sports, almost, you know, tribal in nature in terms of that passion. We love it because it's local complement to the national footprint that is ESPN, where ESPN will be able to take advantage of local inserts and the like to essentially strengthen its product, and the RSNs will be able to take advantage of some of ESPN's programming and strengthen it. Just to give you a for instance, there's kind of, I think, difficulty in navigating finding sports on today in the multi-channel universe. I'm a big NBA fan. A lot of the games are not on national networks, they're on RSNs. Some of them are subject to blackouts. I don't remember the channels. I have navigational issues finding them, all sorts of things. And then there's the issue of when ESPN is on with a game and there are regional games going on, they can't cut into those games often because separate ownership, separate rights, et cetera. Imagine if it was one. And ESPN could immediately say, we're now going to go to, I hope hypothetically, you know, Chicago where the Bulls are playing or whatever. I think it enhances what ESPN is doing. If, again, in that case, the multi-channel ecosystem were to erode, we think we can take all those businesses on a direct-to-consumer basis. They ultimately will be, most of them will be branded ESPN, so they'll look and feel, navigation. Basically, how they're taken to market will all be much more cohesive. So even though there's definitely some increased risk if the multi-channel ecosystem were to erode faster, we believe there are opportunities in all three cases. On the Sky side, this is an incredible business for, we believe, on a variety of fronts. And you have to look at Europe differently than you look at the United States, just in terms of the pace of disruption, where the multi-channel businesses in the countries that Sky operates. And we believe it's a great brand, a really good product, a far more advanced, from a technical perspective, product, user interface, et cetera, than a lot of the products that we're familiar with in the United States. They're also in the program business. They've got a great sports brand, they have a great news brand, and they create other product as well. And Disney's been an important partner of theirs, so we're well familiar with the platform. but we like how they're positioned and do not believe that they are facing the kind of issues that a number of other multi-channel businesses are facing from a disruptive perspective. And they're direct to consumer, and we believe that that's a positive for us. Same thing with Star in India, which is massive in scale. They get about 700 million viewers a month watching product on Star, as a, for instance, own multiple channels, multiple IP creation possibilities in multiple Indian languages. And so again, we international footprint and businesses that we think are fundamentally healthy today. It should be for a while.
Alexia.
Alexia Quadrani from JP Morgan. On the film side, how will you change is Fox's film strategy, if at all? I mean, I think they have many more films of various sizes, budgets each year. Will it pivot more toward a more franchise, tentpole-based strategy that Disney has? And then just on the parks, I guess, where do you see the biggest opportunity of using, this acquisition for the parks?
Jim Brooks, by the way, sent me, I think they might have tweeted it out, a great picture of Homer Simpson essentially grabbing Mickey Mouse. I suggested to him we have a pay-per-view fight. We start with that between Mickey and Homer Simpson and go from there. The park side, clearly, and I'll get to the studio, there are some opportunities. I mean, obviously, we know we've licensed Avatar, and there's a relationship with Jim and a fiduciary responsibility. I don't think that changes all that much. There may be some other opportunities to mine some other franchises, but we're just getting into that, and that's not really part of the value equation here. On the first part, the movie strategy, we've obviously done extremely well with less is more strategy and making just tentpole films. Not all of them are franchises. Coco is a good example of that, an extremely successful film. Pixar branded, so they're branded, but they're not franchises that have huge consumer products or theme park potential, for instance. Fox in the, basically Fox, 20th Century Fox Studios, has some interesting tentpole opportunities. We obviously are going to continue to support that. What they've done, obviously, with Avatar and what they did with Deadpool, X-Men, Fantastic Four, Planet of the Apes is another one. We'll stay in that business. Not all of it will be branded anything other than what it's branded today, as a for instance. How much we will create under that banner, we're still uncertain. This can take a while from a regulatory perspective. They'll continue to develop in that period of time, and at such time as we close this deal and have control, we'll take stock and really look carefully at what their slate looks like going forward and how many movies it makes sense to make. Fox Searchlight is a different story. We've not really been in the lower budget, high quality motion picture business since the heyday of Miramax, really. And we got out of it in part because we weren't doing it well. We like the movie business, though, when done right, and we're quite impressed with what they've done. And since we're not making movies in that space, that's again like FX, a blank that we're filling in that we like. And if managed efficiently, and we believe we'll be able to do that, take advantage of the system that we already have, we think it's a good investment to make an intellectual property that could ultimately feed direct-to-consumer business thereafter. So the output deal eventually, after their current output deals expire, will migrate to our direct-to-consumer offering. And if we think again about a Hulu for adult and a Disney for family, you can see Fox Searchlight's product, Fox 2000, flowing right through Hulu in a direct-to-consumer basis. So unclear fully how it will look, but we'll stay in the tentpole business. Obviously, Marvel will move under, from a supervisory perspective, the Marvel brand, that makes a lot of sense, and we'll be able to take advantage of some cross-pollination opportunities there.
Okay, let's go Todd, Brian, and then Dave.
Thank you. Todd Younger from Bernstein. I guess one for Bob and one for Christine, if I can. Bob, I'd like to explore a little bit with you, if you don't mind, some of the opportunity and direct costs associated with building out the entertainment over OTT services, especially if you think about some of these Fox assets you're acquiring, especially the content library assets. Fox is currently monetizing all that content as much of it as they can, by licensing it to all sorts of people where they can, right? And so presumably, if you want that content for your own service, you're going to have to cut some of those revenue streams off, I guess. And even, I guess, at ABC and Freeform, maybe similarly. You may also have ideas about additional output of your own to fuel some of these services. So I wonder if you've, I'm sure you've, how far you've gone in your thinking about both types of those costs and whether, especially the Fox-related costs, are included in your accretion estimate or if that's to come later on top of that. And then, Christine, the quick one is just, I think the leverage pro forma after the deal is going to be a lot higher than it's been for you guys for a while. I wonder, over time, if there's any thinking about your thoughts on the leverage you want to carry on the company going forward. Thanks.
Todd, in all the modeling that we've done, looking long term, we've built in, one, increased investment in production to feed our OTT services, as well as the impact of not licensing to third parties. Now that, in the Fox case, will take some time on the Disney side too, because there are existing deals, and until those deals expire, the revenue is going to continue to flow, obviously. We believe that in order to be in the OTT business long for the long run, and we think it's the right thing for us to do as a company, we ultimately need to take back control of our content, to license it in effect to ourselves, and to build that business right, both by taking product that's made for other platforms like motion picture theatrical release, but also by using the capability that we have or that we're buying and creating products specifically for those services, either by using IP that they already own, that we already own, and in fact remaking it, or by simply developing new IP using the creative strength that exists at the business that we're buying. So when you think about the management that's supervised the creation of an unbelievable array of great shows, including This Is Us and Modern Family, to name a few, and using that oversight, creative oversight, and the relationships they have with creators to create directly for our service or our networks, that's very, we think, very powerful. And look, direct to consumer, I know, you know, we owe you more answers at some point about the impact of just what we were planning to do, and we'll get to that. We're actually already developing multiple movies and TV series for our direct to consumer platform. I've talked about a Star Wars series, Marvel series. I'm not going to get specific, but we know already what we're thinking about there. In some cases, we've actually hired creative entities to do that. We're creating a series based on the Monsters characters, for instance. There's a High School Musical series, a variety of activities, and obviously cost associated. And then there's the cost associated with ultimately weaning ourselves of the Netflix deal. And we just believe long-term, us having a direct relationship to the consumer is a positive thing for this company in terms of long-term value creation. But it's going to take a reset of sorts in terms of reduction in licensing and some increases in production costs.
So on the leverage, you're absolutely right. The leverage anticipated at close of the transaction, and we've given you that 12 to 18-month period, so it's in that period. You can just assume the midpoint. We're anticipating without Sky, it would go up to 2.2. Now, if you look at our debt over the last few years, it has consistently gone up because the company has gotten larger, but our leverage has stayed well below 2 because our EBITDA has consistently gone up. So our $25 billion of debt currently will add to that the $20 billion of Fox debt. And if you look at it with Sky, we'd also include the Sky debt, and that would take the leverage up to 2.9 times. What we've also incorporated is some buyback assumptions to bring down our accretion dilution analysis, and we're managing that in still reducing leverage because of the cash flow characteristics of not only our company but the combined company. So when you look at that, we are going to bring our leverage down within a 24-month time frame. We met with the agencies, and you may have seen today that all three agencies, S&P, Moody's, and Fitch, came out. S&P, they had upgraded us last summer to, not at our request, but they upgraded us to an A+, and on the short-term basis, an A1+, and they put us on credit watch negative upon review. Both Moody's and Fitch affirmed our single A rating, and our commercial paper rating, which is a tier one, and we are in the commercial paper market on a regular basis, that is being maintained as well. So we feel good about the way our leverage, it does go up, but we're going to manage it back down. We've talked a lot about the strength of our balance sheet, and we've told you that if there was something that was strategic and financially attractive, this is what that balance sheet is for. And I think this opportunity with acquiring 21st Century Fox is a perfect example of that.
Brian. Grab a mic.
Thanks. Brian Weezer, Pivotal Research. A question about the over-the-top businesses and maybe building on Todd's question. Is there anything you can do to characterize what you think the margin profiles ultimately look like, maybe before the content? I mean, you have Disney Life in the UK. I think that there is some experience with the cost of marketing, the cost of serving content. Any color you can offer would be useful. But relatedly, then, you know, today's FCC ruling on net neutrality, do you have any thoughts on how, you know, costs associated with getting through the MVPDs impacts the business?
We won't be specific about what the business is going to look like from a margin perspective. It's just too soon. But what we did in the UK by launching Disney Life is sort of create a product that we could learn from in terms of what the consumer was willing to pay for on the Disney front. One of the first things that we learned is because the product that we were putting on there was not as exclusive as it could have been because we had a Sky license, it was not, our pricing leverage on the app was not particularly strong. So we dropped our price immediately as a for instance. We also learned, rookie mistake at the time, that the app needed to be adapted very, very carefully to basically multiple hardware devices and multiple operating systems. And we were great on Apple devices and the iOS platform, not so great on Android, and the app rating was substantially lower, and that was a bad experience. We bought BAMTech because we knew that we were less experienced than we needed to be in this business at a much more significant basis, and they quickly gave us an education in what was needed. They have unbelievable talent there, technological know-how, technological capabilities, and they will form the basis, as I mentioned earlier, from a technical perspective, and it's very complex to a consumer acquisition and a customer acquisition and customer retention basis, et cetera, and so on. That's vital.
No, net neutrality.
Alan Braverman, who's our general counsel, I mentioned, is here. We talked about this today because in some of the conference and some of the calls we had with people on Capitol Hill, we were actually asked about this. We've not taken a public position on net neutrality. We've been neutral on net neutrality. And I don't think we're not going to take a position today, but we believe that nothing really will be able to stand in the way or in between great content, in-demand content, and the consumer. And if any interloper gets between them in a way that basically diminishes the impact to the consumer from a variety of perspectives, I think that will, you create issues, create trouble. Because we have such great content, we've never really believed that net neutrality, whether there or not, is an issue for us, which is one of the reasons why we haven't taken a position on it. We continue to believe that that's the case. And now that with this acquisition, we have even more confidence in our ability to reach consumers under optimal circumstances, whether there's a net neutrality law in place or not. That's not true for everyone, obviously.
David?
David Miller, Loop Capital Markets. First of all, thank you for taking my question this morning. Really do appreciate that. Question on Sky. I'm not completely clear, Bob, on what happens if the UK regulators decide not to approve the Sky deal for the other 61%. And related to that, you mentioned in your prepared remarks you were just in London. Were you able to meet with Karen Bradley or any of her associates to determine the path to that regulatory approval if, for example, they decide not to approve the deal? And then I would follow up for Christine.
No, I didn't meet with anyone there because we hadn't announced the deal and it would have been premature. What's going on now is, from a regulatory perspective, is an approval process for 21st Century Fox, or the entity, I don't know who the specific entity that's buying it, is it 21st Century Fox name, buying the remainder of it. We're hopeful that they will be successful, and so we then will have the opportunity to take up, obviously, to buy that with this acquisition. If they do not do that, then we have the we will step into Fox's shoes as 39% owners and have the ability to acquire the rest once we have control, once we own it. And one could argue that we might have a better chance of regulatory approval than they've had, but we haven't even put our toe in the water in that regard, but we believe that would be the case, but we're hopeful that they'll gain approval before our deal closes.
Okay, great. And then related to that, Christine, in looking at the capital structure of Fox A, I think the Sky debt is pretty much like, it's pretty good capital structure. I mean, it's like, I think 3.8, 3.9% coupon, but the Fox A debt is like 5.8%. Mm-hmm. It's way above market. So do you see refining that piece like what, like late 18, or is that more of an early 19 project? Your thoughts there. Thank you.
Sure. I think it's fair to say that Disney and Fox have had just fundamentally different approaches to liquidity and financial risk management for their own respective reasons. And if you do look at the way we manage our capital structure, it's a combination of short-term funding and term debt. Our average weighted maturity is a little under 7 years. Our average cost is about 2.5. So it's pretty attractive in this rate environment. Sky is not that dissimilar than we are. It's a little bit longer. It's about, a little over 7 years. And you're right, it's about 3.5%. You look at the Fox debt, and it's got a much longer average weighted life. It's about a little bit, I think it's 14, almost 15 years. And it is approaching 6%. It does trade at a premium. And we will take the opportunity to do some liquidity management trades once the deal is closed. But we think there will be some opportunities, and we will avail ourselves of those.
I want to see if Araka, do you have a question? By the way, Araka here has shown a lot of commitment. He was here meeting with us on Tuesday, flew back to New York to see his newborn, and came back this morning for this meeting. So if you have a question, you let us know. But there's one over here.
Very impressive.
Steve.
Hi, Steve Cahill from RBC. First, I was wondering, in this very unpredictable administration and unpredictable DOJ, from a media perspective, how you're thinking about the regulatory approach and if you have to take maybe a slightly wider aperture to de-risking that than what you might have done 12 months ago. And then secondly, the reason that we were originally coming out here, what sort of numbers are you looking for out of opening weekend?
I'll take the second part of the question. I want to answer it. I've seen estimates that are all over the place. Demand seems pretty high to us. Whether we'll be as high as Force Awakens, we don't know. Probably not, because that was the first Star Wars movie in a long time. On the other hand, this is extremely well reviewed, and it's Carrie Fisher's last film, and very, very satisfying film. So we'll see, but we're not going to put any numbers down. Alan, you want to talk about the regulatory side?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, antitrust analysis is about whether a particular transaction is viewed as pro-competitive from the consumer's perspective. And when we look at this acquisition, as Bob and Christine have described it, what we're looking at is a coming together of two companies that are going to result in an increase in the output of high-quality content that is increasingly in demand, coupled with the ability to make innovative use of technology to deliver content to consumers that, in a fast-evolving world, with regard to broadband distribution, app-based distribution. And you combine those two propositions, and from our perspective, it's a tremendously appealing consumer proposition. So we looked at this very hard and believe that we have very substantial arguments as to why competition authorities should be comfortable with this. The other thing I would note is there's been a lot of talk about, well, this is horizontal, which used to be a bad word until vertical became a bad word. But but you know, one of the ways of thinking about horizontal mergers, the focus should be on the denominator, not the numerator. There's been such an explosion of content from so many multiple sources entrance, really, that 5 years were unimaginable in terms of the number of films being produced by Amazon, the billions of dollars being invested by Netflix and others. And so I think that it is a kind of needs to be a reshaping of what this market really looks like today. We expect questions to be asked. That's what regulatory agencies should do. But we think we have very good answers as to why, at the end of the day, when they keep this in proper perspective, we have very substantial arguments as to why it should be approved.
Kevin, you want to talk about the what ifs there a bit in terms of regulatory judgments? That you want to touch upon that? No.
No.
Okay. It's not. No, it's all right. Okay.
We have funny and protective lawyers here at the Walt Disney Company. I can't see who that is.
It's been a long day.
Jeff, is that you? Can't see.
Hi. First, I guess congratulations on...
Want to introduce yourself? Sorry.
Jeff Mazur with Citadel Asset Management. Congratulations on the deal. I guess my question, a lot of the focus today and on the call this morning that you guys did has been around how this transaction helps kind of your direct-to-consumer, your hopes and that business going forward. I guess separately, can you maybe just talk to, for the parks and the consumer products business, like some of the IP you're pulling in, and what do you think that can help you accomplish in those businesses as well?
I don't know that there's, as I mentioned earlier, I don't know that there are many parks opportunities at this point. There are some, but... I don't think that's a particularly significant part of the value equation here, if any. Consumer products, they've done well with certain properties. Simpsons would be probably most successful. Some of the Marvel properties, perhaps Avatar. But again, compared with the sizes of the franchises and the consumer products business that we have, it's relatively limited. There may be some opportunities, but you're not talking about big needle movers from those businesses.
Michael?
So, Bob, I have two for you. Michael Nathanson, Muffin Nathanson. Do you think going forward that leagues will start selling rights on a global basis? You saw that with cricket and Star. So is that part of the strategy play here that perhaps is a global sports rights market that you guys can tap into?
I think there'll be some opportunities there, but I'm not sure that there'll be many. We do have an opportunity to extend the ESPN brand globally. As you know, they're primarily a U.S.-centric brand. They've got some small businesses outside the U.S., including Latin America, but it's tiny. Fox's footprint sports-wise is tremendous. They have a very big business across Latin America. They have big business in India, big business in Europe through Sky. And we'll be careful there because some of those regional or local sports brands have real brand equity. We think where they don't or where there are opportunities to attach the ESPN brand to them and to manage a little bit more cohesively, we'll certainly take a look at that. In terms of rights, though, acquisition, I don't see it.
Okay, and then can I ask you about Fox TV Studios? It's ironic that Fox's Studios more hits on other networks than on Fox. If you look at This Is Us, Modern Family for you, Homeland, I wonder, is that a culture that you want to maintain to pretty much be an independent studio embedded in a broadcast network that would like to have more of that product? So how do you think about that potential conflict of go-to-market strategy?
Well, we certainly are intent on creating a larger, unified television production studio for the company. One that is creating product not just for the platforms that we've talked about, but will probably maintain relationships with third parties as well, because it's generally good business. But it'll be used to feed the various businesses that we've talked about, the existing channels as well as the OTT service. And that'll probably be the priority, but we wouldn't rule out the ability to, or the possibility of creating and selling to others.
Paul.
Thank you. Paul Swinney from Bloomberg Intelligence. As you increase the investment you're making in the sports business, can you talk to us, and no one has a better view on sports rights than I would think your company. Can you give us a sense of how you think sports rights are going to evolve over the next, I don't want to, you know, 3 to 5 years, given some of the changing economics on the revenue side for sports, particularly in this country, the inflation that you and your peers have been, you know, dealing with in terms of sports rights is just extraordinary. How do you think about sports rights now that you're making a bigger investment in sports over the next 3 to 5 years in terms of rights?
It's a very good question. I'm not sure we can answer it with any degree of accuracy because we just don't know. What we do know, and I'll state the obvious, is that there are some new entrants in the marketplace. So far, those entrants have been, they've been around and buying things opportunistically, but they've not been in any of the really gigantic big sports rights commitments negotiations. I guess there was one in India not long ago for cricket rights, and Facebook stepped up and made a fairly competitive bid. But beyond that, they haven't sat down yet and faced the notion of billions of dollars in commitment to put on an ecosystem that, at least for now, hasn't been designed necessarily to bring in the kind of revenue for those rights that might be required. So it's possible, because they're definitely looking at sports as a means of attracting more customers or growing their own platforms. On the other hand, I think it's possible that their ability to swallow the kind of commitments that would be necessary and monetize them appropriately is still sort of unclear. So I guess we don't know. And I don't think the reason, one of the reasons why there hasn't been a gigantic negotiation in the United States for a package, I guess the NBA would have been the last one.
Big Ten
was another one, yes. And there, the competition was, did not include any of the new entrants to our knowledge.
And I think also, Paul, what the Big Ten deal, I think, demonstrated was that I think leagues and conferences do have some desire to continue to be in business with ESPN. There was one where we were not prepared to take the same package that we had in the last round of deals. Big Ten went out. They found a partner in Fox who was willing to pay them substantially more than we were, but they still wanted us to be in that deal, so they cleaved off a piece of the package for us. And I think that does speak to the benefit that the ESPN brand does provide. But I don't know that that's necessarily a barometer for what's going to happen. I mean, I guess NFL and baseball would be the two big ones coming up in several years. Araka, yes. Welcome back.
Hey, Bob. So historically, you've put your content on platforms that have pretty broad reach. As you go down the path of building your own DTC, which out of the gate wouldn't have as much reach as some of the other platforms you've used, how do you decide which content goes on those broader reach platforms versus which content goes on these newer platforms to help build that business?
Well, what we're bullish about our prospects in the OTT space to ultimately gain a fair amount of reach. We think actually we'll be able to launch with some decent reach. But when we do launch, we'll still be in the Disney Channel business. So we'll have significant reach from a television perspective there. And we'll also be in the business of making Disney films and Marvel and Pixar and Lucas, et cetera, for the reach that the theatrical platform will provide us. And so reach is not really that much of a concern to us now for those businesses. We did make a decision some years back, I think it was 2012, to move our studio output deal from then Starz, which was an existing platform with reach, to Netflix, which was a nascent platform. They paid us handsomely for that, and we decided there the trade-off was worth it. We believed they'd ultimately grow, but we had no idea how fast they would grow and what kind of reach they'd ultimately provide. Turned out to be okay. We're going to take the same approach with our own product, feeling bullish about its prospects and believe that we'll be able to replace the reach of the platforms that we're currently putting them on and balance it with the reach that we're getting from other platforms.
All right. Any other questions? I think we have one more. I see two hands. Okay, so I see Jeff and maybe Marcy. I can't actually tell. Is that Marcy? Welcome, Marcy. So Jeff, why don't you go, then Marcy go, and then I know Bob and Christine have been here over 12 hours at this point today, so I think we'll let them go after that. So Jeff?
Jeff Logsdon from JBL Advisors. Christine, for you, perhaps it's a moving target on quicksand, but can you talk about taxes, and should there end up being a corporate tax rate down in the low 20s somewhere, how that would benefit you, and also kind of this accelerated depreciation or capital investment. You got a lot of both of those things, you know, in your portfolio as well. Thanks.
Sure. Tax reform is still going through its process. It's a fascinating process, but it seems to have more traction than we've had in prior instances. You can think about Disney as a relatively full taxpayer. Our effective tax rate is in the, call it, 34% range. So the latest that's been out in the press is a federal tax rate of about 21%. If that were to happen, you could see that it would have a significant impact on us on both a cash tax basis, on an annual ongoing basis. And we'd also have some revaluation of deferred tax assets at the time that it comes in. So that would be a one-time plus the ongoing. As it relates to full expensing, if that holds together, it given our investment in things like parks and resorts, that would be very beneficial. But that's not fully finalized. But once again, that's a potential upside. There's a few things that in the current drafts between the House and the Senate that we would lose. But on a net basis, we would definitely be favorably impacted. And the single biggest driver is going to be the rate. Also, on this particular deal, if tax reform were to take place, there would be an upside to the value creation. We haven't quantified that, but it's a very nice uplift for the whole deal.
And I think I'd also just note, because Kevin and I have spent a lot of time talking about this, this deal is going to drive meaningful value, drives more value if you assume the Sky acquisition is completed, and then you have another piece on top of that, which are the taxes mm-hmm. that Christine talked about. So the NPV that we're looking at grows with each of those occurrences. Yeah.
Meaningfully.
All right, Marcy, want to take us home?
Sure. For the networks that you're acquiring, are you inheriting the affiliation agreements that Fox made with the MVPDs? Are these things that you can open, or do you wait until those agreements are up for renewal and then you bring them into the Disney negotiations?
We're inheriting them. Some could be extended in the period of time before we close as well. We're inheriting them.
Okay, Bob, Christine, thank you. Thanks, everyone, for being here today. We are going to end the webcast now. So thanks, everyone, who joined us on the webcast.